When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition comic book podcast, where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, is... What was your name again?
Fred.
Fred. Yeah, I vaguely remember doing a podcast with you. It was at some point.
Yeah, we did that once.
Of course, I kid. It is Brian Reese. How are you, Brian?
I'm doing good. We both have our face masks on while we're doing this, right?
Of course. I'm wearing a full body mask, actually.
We joke. These are serious times, and I think we're all a little bit on edge and a little bit nervous, and which had to do with some of the delay here and various other reasons. But I think we both wish all of our listeners well and safety and all of that as well. And we're all in this together.
Oh, absolutely.
Separately, we're separately in this together.
We're all in this together at a safe distance. So. Yes. I hope everyone is doing well out there, and you're keeping yourself safe and healthy, and making sure we're going to get through this. So everything's going to be fine, but we just have to, you know, work together to make sure it works out to the best outcome for everyone.
And hey, you know, I mean, here we are in two separate states, so we're not breathing on each other.
Yeah, that's true. So today on the program, we'll be discussing Doom Patrol, the painting that ate Paris. Written by Grant Morrison with art by Richard Case. This is our second listener request. This one was by Herman Lowe of the Into the Weird and Long Box of Darkness podcasts. Go listen to them. They're wonderful. He's been doing great work. It's been a while since this request was made, so I hope it lives up to expectations. Remains to be seen. If it doesn't, it's free. So, you know.
Apologies if we let you down.
Yeah. But first, Brian. As we kind of alluded to, since the last time we were together, the world ended and comics stopped happening. How you been holding up in regards to that?
Well, you know, I'm a 40 to 50 comic a month guy, so...
So you're cold turkey right now.
I'm a bit in cold turkey. What has been great is, you know, and as I've seen, so I work in the book industry, and we do... We sell a lot of collected editions, as it were, graphic novels, both old and new, online, wholesale, various other ways. But what has been interesting is not just seeing the incredible spike in books selling now online, but our graphic novel sales are going bananas too. And I think and so this is what I've experienced as well, is, man, you know, the amount of literally again, collected editions, I keep plugging us
inadvertently, but yeah.
Inadvertently, but it has been interesting seeing I think a lot of us who are fans of comics, both old and new, those of us who continue to read new stuff coming out, you know, the lack of monthly floppies has, I've seen, you know, I think we're all going back and reading old stories.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
In a way that maybe we haven't been before. It's, we all need our fix. I think that's one of the things about comic collectors is, and comic fans, is we need our monthly fix. And if we don't have our monthly fix, then we're getting it elsewhere. So, yeah, you know, it's been, I've had a chance to go back and, you know, I caught up on everything.
I'm getting there too. I mean, I don't get nearly as many comics monthly as you do, but at the same time, I miss them coming in, you know. There's certain storylines that I'm like, more, 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 please. But, you know, it's nice to have things like Comixology and Marvel Unlimited to be able to get some old comics. You know,
so right, and the DC app, which I subscribe to, has been pretty great.
Yeah, but that leads us into, since you do work in the world of reading, so we were kind of going to try to speculate, you know, what will become of the comic book industry once this is all said and done, because there are some stores that are struggling right now.
Well, not just struggling. We've seen a lot of stores that are just like,
yeah, we lost them.
Are never going to reopen.
Yeah, it's that's a loss. I mean, we'd love to have independent, not just comic book stores, but bookstores, and you know, it's important to have those things.
Right.
You know, where I live, the big comic book stores like Mile High Comics, that's not going anywhere.
And where I live, you know, Chicago Comics, I think will probably be, I hope we'll be okay. You know, obviously you have the big places like Midtown in New York and. Right. And DCBS, sort of online distributor and subscription service. You know, I hope all of those will be okay as well. But I mean, so many smaller stores that cater to, you know, smaller communities. Just, you know, they're so dependent on basically Wednesday sales.
Well, yeah.
And not back stock, and I just
right now that's not happening either. So
right, it looks like Diamond is going to get back into distribution sometime this month.
Last I heard, I thought it was going to start last week, but apparently that's been moved pushed.
Well, I think there's been a few things. DC is distributing through two other, they're distributing a few other comics now weekly through a few other venues, DCBS being one of them, and I think there's another one, and I can't remember which one it is. So there is a trickle right now of some DC comics coming through, but...
I think there's going to be a big shakeup. No, I don't think you'll hear a lot of people online speculate, oh, the comics industry is dead and, you know, it's a dying industry. It's not. The death of comics has been predicted many times over the decades, at least in my lifetime, and it obviously not happened. So right. there's it's going to take a big hit. Obviously that's going to be a thing, but
we're going to lose some good comic book companies too. We're losing some good comic book stores. We're probably going to lose some good comic book companies. I'm not a businessman. I can't speculate on, you know, who. I mean, DC and Marvel are going to be fine because they're basically IPs for larger companies. I think Image will probably be okay because it's creator driven. But beyond that, I mean, I don't know, you know, and, well, there's a lot of smaller comic book companies who are putting out stuff that I really, really like. I don't know what's going to happen to those. I don't know what's going to happen to those series that I've been reading that I won't get to finish. And that's selfish because what's going to happen to the creators of those and the people who get paychecks because of that. I can't complain because this comic book series I like, I can't read anymore. That's ridiculous. You know, that's a really self-involved thing. Whereas, you know, the concern is for the creators and the artists and the editors and, you know, the people behind the scenes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I just think that when all is said and done, there's probably going to be a restructuring of how comics are distributed because obviously there was a flaw there.
Right.
So I don't know what that's going to look like. I am not that much of an insider that I'm by that much of an insider, I mean, I'm not an insider at all.
Right.
So I don't know exactly what that's going to look like, but it feels like there's going to be a sea change when all is said and done. But hopefully things will be better and distribution will be faster and more diverse. And hopefully those smaller companies will be able to stick, you know, hang in there and benefit from that.
And perhaps this exposes Diamond a little bit. That's as kind of the the sole sort of monopoly on comics distribution. So may you live in interesting times. And let's be, again, just to clarify, there are people who are dealing with like so many worse things than the comic book industry. So, but we talk about comics. While we want to acknowledge, all of the various things that are going on in the world right now. But at the end of the day, this is a comic book podcast. So we're talking about how it affects, we're not a political show. We're not an economic show. We're a comic book show. So we don't want to seem cold hearted and, you know, oh, this is first world problems.
Well, I mean, and it is a creative medium. There are artists and writers out there who are struggling because you know, comics doesn't pay a lot.
No. Anybody who thinks there may be like 10 creators who make really good money at comics, and then the rest of them make a living.
Exactly.
If they're lucky.
But that kind of leads, you had mentioned earlier, like some of the smaller companies, you know, may struggle, we may lose them. One of the smaller companies that I have been enamored with over the last couple of years is Boom.
Yeah.
Who I think is really producing some great comics out there. And they have signed a deal with Netflix to produce series and movies based on their properties. That was really interesting to me because, I mean, you were talking about Lumberjanes and Once in Future has been a huge, you know, the Kieran Gillen.
Right.
You know, for me, there's Something's Killing the Children, which would make a wonderful series, I think, on the more horror side. But they have a lot of properties that will adapt, I think, very well to a cinematic version of them. Right. So, I mean, so, and I think,
By the way, to let everybody know, our usual special guest star has shown up and will be chatting with us here for a few minutes until we take a break and he gets fed. So everybody should enjoy the dulcet tones of Nucky in the background.
All will be well for a little while. Anyway, that's all I really wanted to say about Boom. I just hope that, first of all, I think these are going to make for some good shows and a movie or two. But I hope that keeps a small company like them alive and allows them to bring in more creators and get more titles out there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, perhaps we'll see a chance for, you know, companies to diversify and perhaps even more, you know, companies being able to license out to television and film and whatever. And maybe television and film will start looking even more intensely at properties that aren't just superheroes, like in the same way that Boom and some of the other smaller companies.
Yes, I agree with you 100%, but that cat wants to be fed. Let's take a break.
Yes.
let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about Doom Patrol.
In 2014, two comic fans joined forces to do a Doom Patrol podcast. As there was no Doom Patrol comic series at the time, they called it Waiting for Doom.
That was us, me, Mike, and him, Paul.
In 2016, DC Comics became fearful of the power of Waiting for Doom and sought to appease us by bringing the comic back.
That's not exactly how it went.
In 2018, terrified of the sheer horde organizing power of Waiting for Doom, DC Universe announced a Doom Patrol TV show.
I think they were planning that without us.
In 2019, they again brought back the Doom Patrol comic, hoping we would not smite them.
This makes no sense.
In 2021, they realized we were the most unstoppable force in existence and released the Doom Patrol movie.
This is pure fantasy now.
In 2022, a terrified Motion Picture Academy awarded the Doom Patrol movie every single Oscar, including Best Documentary and Foreign Language Film.
That's enough, Paul. Look, we just love the Doom Patrol and have fun talking about them. You can find us on all podcast places and now Spotify.
And check out our website, waitingfordoom.com, or we will wipe you out, all of you.
And 3, 2, and we're back. Paul. Today we're going to be talking about Doom Patrol. This was a recommendation from one of our listeners. Would you like to tell us about it?
Doom Patrol was created in 1963 by Arnold Drake, Bob Haney, and Bruno Premiani. It followed the adventures of a superhero team led by a brilliant professor confined to a wheelchair and a group of normal men that became different than normal men. Like, they weren't men anymore. They were kind of like, I don't know, X-Men.
Oh-ho!
Anyway, after some initial success, the popularity of the book waned and was canceled due to low sales. A couple of revivals proved fruitless until the team was launched again post-crisis, first by Paul Kupperberg, but then handed over to a relatively unknown British writer and soon-to-be magician and snake lord, Grant Morrison. And that's when things got weird. Morrison was pretty much given carte blanche to let his creative instincts go wild. And aided by the art of Richard Case, the book became a psychedelic fever dream filled with literary references, art theory, and philosophy. Absurdity reigns supreme. Case in point, the arc we're discussing today, The Painting That Ate Paris. It deals with an anarchic band of criminals called the Brotherhood of Dada that trapped the city of Paris in a painting, literally. Led by the groovy Mr. Nobody, who can alter reality, and consisting of the fog, a psychedelic cloud capable of absorbing people, frenzy, an illiterate living cyclone, sleepwalk, a girl with tremendous strength, but only when asleep, and quiz, a woman that has every power you haven't thought of. Together, they set off to bring unreason to reality by creating a surreality made real. And if that doesn't make sense, exactly. And the only team bizarre enough to combat this existential threat is the psychological mess that is the Doom Patrol. What follows is a disjointed journey through layers of abstract art, postmodern theories, and mental strife that confounds the laws of logic and confuses even Superman. It is, in short, a brilliant romp through the nooks and crannies of Morrison's very weird mind. To say that Morrison's run on Doom Patrol was influential is an understatement. It opened up vast possibilities inherent in serialized storytelling. It expanded the ways in which visuals informed narrative, opened the door to philosophical musings and avant-garde literary techniques to be used in comics, and laid the foundations for what would become the magnificent strangeness that is the career of Grant Morrison. Brian, what do you think of Doom? What do you think of Doom Patrol?
Well, I think we've discussed this before. Grant Morrison may be my favorite comic book writer, so I feel as like he has had a few missteps through his career, but I don't think that many really. I you know, his action comics, the New 52 Action Comics, was probably not one of his finest moments. But shoot, I mean, I even like Final Crisis.
But for someone who's had a career as long as his, and the fact that he's just tried new things, constantly tried new things.
Well, and that's the point.
And none of it, not all of it works, but that's saying something though, because he gave it a shot. He wasn't just sticking with, okay, this worked for me, so I'll just keep doing that over and over and over again. He tried to expand his horizons and try new things.
He's a restless creator.
Yes. Snake Lord.
And the fact that, so is this our, I think this is our second Grant Morrison. We did Animal Man.
So basically the same period.
I think eventually we're going to do All-Star Superman.
Yes. And I want to do Seven Soldiers as well. But
right. Seven Soldiers. I mean, Invisibles would be difficult.
That's a podcast all on its own.
Yeah, that's probably rated MA. But
Martial arts?
Yes. So when you ask what I think about this, well, this is one of my favorite comics. What did I think about it? Well, I loved it, of course. I am not coming into this unbiased and with like virgin, eyes and comprehension. So what did I think of it? Well, of all the times that I've read and reread the Doom Patrol, it was interesting going into this where I had to read it to talk about it, as opposed to read it just to read it, and spend several hours researching every single reference in the comic.
I don't think that's possible. There's a lot of references in here.
There's a lot of references. And for our purposes, we could go into the weeds on this easily. But
yes.
Who has the time in an hour, hour and a half, 2 hour, 5 hour podcast to listen to that? So I think we'll see where you lead this. I think you are going to kind of take the lead on this in some ways, but it's. I think we have an interesting discussion ahead of us, however limited.
Yes. Well, first of all, I should say that a lot of credit has to be given to DC and to Vertigo at this time to allow this, because Morrison had gained a reputation in Britain as a comic book writer of some renown, but here in the US, relatively unknown. And to allow him to take control, I mean, it wasn't a a huge title at the time.
Right. No.
You know, so a new artist could be put on this. And with Animal Man, but to give him the amount of freedom that he was given to craft his stories and to style these characters the way he wanted to, you know, a lot of credit has to go to them, because that's a big chance. To allow him to do what he did with this title was impressive.
Well, and I think, but in some ways, I think they were just, we have this property, we have to keep the property going for, we see this all the time with certain properties in comics. Certain properties have to be revived or kept relevant in some way for them to retain rights. I think, like, in some ways, this was just, we got to keep a Doom Patrol going for X amount of time or for whatever reason. Let's give it to this crazy, weird British guy. We'll probably have to cancel it. But, you know, we're not really going to have any kind of oversight on this comic because we don't care. No. I think Mark Waid was an editor for a couple issues.
Still, regardless, he did some pretty outrageous things with this title. And, you know, a lot of credit has to be given to people just to say, okay, let him run, let him roll with it.
And I think it was kind of a minor hit. And you see, like, if folks can have an opportunity to reread this with the letters pages, highly recommended. We're not going to talk about the letters pages, but I'll tell you, okay, comics like this, the letters pages are a lot of fun.
Yes, it even bled over into the Animal Man run of his, because people would write into Animal Man to talk about how good Doom Patrol is. Oh, all that being said, this particular story arc, as wild and off the wall as it is actually probably the most, or one of the most straightforward linear stories he tells in this run.
Right.
Because, you know, there's a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yes.
Strange things happen, but...
And it is very succinct, because I think, you know, it should be noted. So this collection that we're reading is, it's actually 9 issues, and there are 4 separate stories in this. The painting that ate Paris is one of the stories. There are 2 kind of one-offs, and then there's also the Decreator storyline.
The Cult of the Uncreated Word.
Right.
Well, yeah, unwritten word. Called it the unwritten
word. The unwritten word, yeah.
They all kind of play off of one another, too, because as we'll get into, it's all about art and literature. But let's start with The Pain That Ate Paris, because this may take up the bulk of what we talk about.
Yeah.
So essentially what happens is there's a fellow named Mr. Nobody. See, I don't want to call them villains, because they're not so much villains as they are.
They're not.
They're pranksters.
Yeah.
Yes. So these kind of outrageous, quote unquote, supervillains create a painting that literally swallows Paris within it. The entire city and all the people swallows Paris within the painting itself. And the Justice League are called in to try to help with this, and they're flummoxed. They have no clue what's happening or what to do. Because they think this is a normal, they think this is a regular comic where superheroes can just swoop in and punch their way to victory. And that's not how a Grant Morrison comic works.
Well, it's a great setup too, because initially when, after the painting is stolen, now this is an existing painting.
Yes.
And there's a lot of theory about the painting and who created it and how it was created.
It's an infinite regress painting. So it's like those memes that you see where there's a painting of the painting within the painting within the painting, and it keeps going back forever.
And suggests madness and a variety of things.
Right.
But what's great is, so the setup, it takes a little while to get to the scene where you're talking about where the Justice League shows up. But once some of the action happens and Paris is swallowed up into this painting and the Doom Patrol shows up there, it's Buddy Baker, it's Animal Man, it's Blue Beetle, and it's Booster Gold are the 3 heroes who were sent in to investigate. And so, of course, you know, I love the fact that it's not the A team, it's not the B team, it's not even really the C team, it's what at the time was considered the D-listers.
Yeah,
who are kind of gathered around this painting going, well, what the heck happened?
Yeah, they're completely confused. Yeah, and even the heavy hitters don't know what's going on. But I do love the way that, you know, everyone's confounded by the whole thing, but the Doom Patrol just kind of saunters up and says, yeah, we got this. And they recite some automatic poetry.
Yes.
And suddenly they too are transported into the painting itself. And this is when the story becomes a metaphor of psychology, I think, a metaphor for for inner life.
Right.
You know, we can get into all right, so this is my take on it anyway.
Okay.
That it is it's how, and this will tie into the later stories as well. It's, you know, someone's inner mind. At one point, they first get transported into the painting, and Robot Man, Steel, says, I feel flat and unreal the way I get when I'm depressed. And that's what launches us into the inner workings of our mind. And this is when Morrison, you know, really lets loose his, you know, creative inner juices, as it were. That's kind of gross.
Well, but I think because you raise an interesting point. So remember, like, the three sort of major members of the Doom Patrol, there are some peripheral characters that are mm-hmm. dealt with in a typical 80s DC and Marvel fashion, where you have stories building in the background. And so you have various other members of the Doom Patrol, Dorothy, Rhea, even Calder, who have some various scenes but are not really part of the primary action. So when you have the three sort of primary characters in this, Robot Man, who is Cliff Steele, who is literally a robot, he has a brain, and, you know, so he has no inner life other than his brain. He is a hollow shell. He's a robot man. You have Larry Traynor, Rebus, who is becoming something other, hermaphroditic in some ways, and all his inner life is an energy being.
Yes, but he's you know, he's becoming hermaphroditic, but he's also a fusion between a white man and a black woman.
Right.
So he's both queer and biracial, which is an incredible thing to character. Yeah.
And then you have Jane, and her character's name, just as a caveat, her character's name this early on is Crazy Jane.
Right.
And I going forward, I'm going to just call her Jane for a lot of reasons. And, you know, people can decide how they want to react to that. But going forward, I'm just going to call her Jane. But Jane is has over 50 multiple personalities.
Yeah, something like 64 personalities, and each personality has its own unique power.
Power, right. Yeah. And so Jane is also has this. So all of this is to refer to, like you're talking about, the internal life. And so you have a hollow body, you have a conflicted body, like with two personalities becoming one personality, and then you have another person with multiple personalities within. I mean, you see like a really interesting line of delineation between the three. So I bring that up to agree with your initial assessment psychologically of, like, that's done on purpose.
Exactly. And I think that it makes a lot of sense that Morrison would grab to those three characters, because they're the ones that he plays with the most. I mean, there are, like you said, there are peripheral characters or other members of the Doom Patrol that are there and are developed quite well. But at the same time, these three main characters are the ones that Morrison focuses on. And right. They're the ones with the most unique and conflicted personalities. All right, so the storyline is very simple. The three main characters descend through the layers of the paintings, each layer representing a different style of art, until they reach the bottom and then have to get out. That's essentially the story. How the story plays out is, it's not so much what the story is, it's the details of each interaction that they have.
Right.
Okay. So the Brotherhood of Dada that I mentioned in the synopsis or introduction. So, I mean, are you familiar with what Dadaism is, what Dada is as a, as an art movement? Okay. So
this is way more your expertise than mine. So, I'm going to,
in a nutshell, to those who aren't familiar with Dada, it was a reaction to World War I. There was so much violence and destruction and loss of life. I mean, it was unfathomable to the point where it became absurd. The amount of destruction was absurd. So Dada was trying to reflect that. It's a group of artists and writers who thought, if there's no respect for life, then nothing has meaning. So they expressed this by creating nonsense, by, you know, rejecting logic and reason. And they had an aesthetic of no aesthetic. It's just crazy off the wall. Nothing has meaning. Nothing has anything. So that's what the Brotherhood is trying to do. They're trying to turn the world into meaningless abstractness.
Which in and of itself has meaning, but...
Well, many Dada artists, after, you know, would go on in their careers to become surrealists or cubists or
Fluxes.
Yeah, or any manner of abstract and modernist art. Mm-hmm. So they would go on to that, and I think Morrison expresses this, you know, because they descend through the painting and they descend through various kinds of art. They go from photorealism to impressionism, cubist, futurist, surrealism. They keep getting crazy. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Through all of this, like Richard Case, Richard Case, Richard Case.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Richard Case. The champion of this, because it couldn't have been easy to have Morrison say, okay, so then they go from a futurist painting into a surrealist painting, and a sleepwalking woman who listens to Barry Manilow is going to punch a robot man while a cyclone comes in. So yeah. So for him to be able to visualize these concepts, you know, stellar work.
Yeah.
So I was saying, like, they descend through all these different kinds of art, you know, from realism to more abstract, to the point where they reach the bottom and it's complete nothing. And that's where they reach the real danger. The real danger is trying to find meaning in all this around them, if that makes sense. But it doesn't make sense. That's kind of the point.
Except it does. It doesn't. I mean, it's so various things. Some of the various things occurring here are, of course, what they reach, of course, is the fifth horseman, right?
Yes, the fifth horseman.
Is that what you're leading to? If I jumped the narrative,
I don't think. I think we can kind of fly all over the place on this one because yeah. But eventually, they do reach the fifth horseman, which is at the bottom of everything.
Right, and the fifth horseman is oblivion. You know, nothingness. But as the fifth horseman comes into reality, or whatever that the version of reality that we're dealing with here is, that so the fifth horseman is only given meaning when it's thought about,
exactly, and or if someone attempts to depict it,
right?
So, and so art itself creates, actually visualizes oblivion. Yeah,
but as it becomes thought about and becomes a reality, and then it's sent back up through the painting,
exactly,
going through each of these different art and architectures. So architecture is also very important to this, and I'm not an architecture expert by any means, so I couldn't I can't sit here and pretend to define each of those periods that are represented architecturally throughout this either. But it becomes more solid and becomes more real as it ascends through the painting, which also is in conflict with the concept, with the idea that it's nothing and that it's oblivion, because it's starting to be given.
Yes, oblivion. Yeah, oblivion is given form by our conceiving of it,
mm-hmm.
which is fascinating. Yeah. But the thing about it is, the whole point of Dada is to express nothingness, to create nonsense, to create anti-art. And when you reach the bottom where oblivion is, that's the thing that gave birth to Dada, is oblivion. The you know, the horrors of war and the horrors of the everything that's wrong with human nature. That's what gave birth to this movement. So it makes sense that that is the only thing that can destroy the fifth horseman.
Right.
Using anti-art to destroy the art that created this.
The art that created something out of nothing then... is that then destroyed by the nothing that it had originally been before it began to take form?
Yes, and it's so fantastic. Yes, the more you dig into it, and the more you read these stories, the more you read these issues, it blows your mind. I mean, how old was Morrison at this time? In his 20s, right?
12.
And to know that he's thinking about these things, and God, this was so mind blowing for comics at the time.
Well, it's mind blowing now too.
Yeah.
I mean, it is, like, I don't know how many times I have read Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol. I own the stinking floppies, you know? I own the trade, and I own digital. And every time I read it, I still, the layers and layers and layers.
And there's so much more to pick out of it. And just, you know, as my reading of literature and philosophy and learning about art. As I start to learn stuff, I can go back and read these and say, oh, well, he was already talking about these things. You know what I mean? I'm just starting to become aware of certain things that he was writing about decades ago.
Right.
And it adds a new layer to it.
And there's so much more to this story. I mean, this is the bare bones of it. But Mr. Nowhere is one of the great creations in comics, and just the complete lunacy, the insane, sane lunacy of, and I don't mean that pejorative. I mean, you know, in how we react to a world that doesn't make sense around us. It's just he's such a fascinating character, and it's like you said, he's not, we call them villains, but they're not really villains. And he and the other characters that he drafts or that he brings into the Brotherhood of Dada, every one of them has such a unique personality and a unique story. And we don't have the time or to go into each one, but I think Lloyd in particular, the Frenzy,
right,
who is given a whole narrative in one of the comics and is probably one of the more tragic characters. Once you get his story, and it's done through this letter that he's writing this to his parents, his mother, who clearly he was abandoned and what have you. And, you know, he's a killer. He's, you know, kind of a bad guy, but he's not really a bad guy. And you get this sense of it. And it's very interesting that Morrison, it's just one issue and it's not the whole issue, but the issue is framed on like this letter that he's writing, and it appears and disappears and reappears throughout this particular issue. It's the final issue of the Paris that ate, or the painting that ate Paris. But you get a real sympathy for this stock character.
Yeah, well, it would have been a stock character.
What would have been a stock character, and he gets a happy ending.
Yeah, in a sense, he's able to live his own life free of judgment from others.
Right, because the Brotherhood are trapped. They end up being trapped in the painting, but they're not really trapped because they choose to stay.
Yes, they have the opportunity to leave, but choose to stay because the only times that they felt accepted was with the absurdity of Mr. Nobody.
Right.
You know,
and with each other.
And with each other, exactly. Because these were people who, you know, they were, you called Booster Gold and Animal Man D-listers. They would have been much farther down the line with their powers.
I mean, they're Z-list villains, except for the Quiz, who I love the Quiz, and we should, like, so her character is, her superpowers are things you haven't thought of.
Right. As soon as you think of a power.
Who comes up with that? Grant Morrison does.
Exactly. So as soon as you think of a power, she no longer has it. But as long as you don't think of it, she has that power.
Right.
Another little quirk is she's deathly afraid of dust and dirt, so has to wear a hazmat suit. It's wonderful.
But all of this is, you know, I mean, it's, there's so much more to this story, and it's there's great peripherals like Eichmann, the collector of strange curiosities, mm-hmm. that they steal the painting from, you know, and the painting was created by Paranisi, right? So and Paranisi, like, I had to look him up, and he has actually like a real kind of photorealist artist, and would do these buildings and things, and there was, you know, he wasn't M.C. Escher, but there was some oddity to the buildings or whatever. And so the concept is that this painting was created by this guy Paranisi, a real artist, and then was destroyed. And then numerous other artists tried to recreate it, and it took like someone in an insane asylum, another artist, Max Gordengast, who recreated this painting, and then the comic leads us to believe that he was absorbed into the painting, because the painting eats, you know, it's a painting that absorbs and eats those who observe it. So you are consumed literally by that which you observe.
Exactly. And once it consumes you, it transforms you into your baser nature.
Right.
Diffusing reality into unreality.
The layers, so there are layers suggested and literally represented within this entire story arc.
Exactly.
Doom Patrol themselves are kind of bit players in all of this.
No, but, I mean, yes, they are bit players in this, but I like that. I like the fact that Morrison is using the Doom Patrol as conduits to tell a greater story.
Right.
It, in much the same way that Steve Gerber used to do with his stories from the 70s, whether it was Man-Thing or Howard the Duck, he used them in sort of, he used those characters to get as an in to get to a larger concept.
Right.
And Morrison does the same thing, arguably to a better degree. And that's saying something because I'm a huge Gerber fan. So, right.
Well, they're different and their approaches were different. And Morrison had a lot more allowance, I think, than Gerber did, because I think Gerber's clashes with editorial are kind of notorious.
Yes. And that kind of gets back to what I was saying in the beginning about how Morrison was given free rein to do this kind of thing. And you have other artists who tried and were kind of halted, you know,
right.
Yeah, you're getting a little bit too weird there, Steve. You have to settle down. So I think it's fantastic that Grant Morrison was able to be given the opportunity to create these stories. The fact that the Doom Patrol are used as, you know, they're sort of the focal point that the Brotherhood of Dada and all these philosophical ideas and artistic and art theory ideas can revolve around them. But it's interesting how they start confident, but every layer they descend through the painting, their own personal idiosyncrasies, their own personal trauma begins to come forward. So that the farther, the closer they get to oblivion, the more broken they become.
Right.
And that's a fascinating thing as well, because that's going to carry beyond this arc into other story arcs.
In the future arcs. And
exactly.
I think one of the things this set up too, that we see in, there's the Painted Day of Paris, then there's a one-off, which is a very harrowing issue involving, and we could talk about this, as I'm just kind of mentioning these to, so the next issue once this story arc ends is a one-off where Cliff has to go into Jane's mind.
Yes, because, all right, so it should be mentioned at the end of this, Jane is able to ride oblivion because of her fractured mind and all her different personalities. She's the only one who could ride oblivion and keep it under control while the rest of the characters hold hands and sing about nothing.
And by all characters, we mean like the Doom Patrol meets up with the Brotherhood of Dada, and they literally, all of them hold hands.
They hold hands and sing nonsense, which turns Oblivion into a rocking horse, because of course it does.
And Superman doesn't know what to do once the rocking horse comes. Anyway.
So Jane is injured while doing that. You know, it takes a lot out of her to do that.
Right. So her mind is fractured. There's a lot of things. And we could get back to this, but I just kind of want to draw one of the overriding themes. So Mr. Nowhere, so in this story arc, Mr. Nowhere is initially represented as living, if you could call it living, is obviously a loose phrase.
I'm gonna cut you off real quick. Is it Nowhere or Nobody?
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Nobody. Have I been saying Mr. Nowhere like this whole? Oh,
I know. I just noticed it. So,
whoops.
I'll fix it in post. It's all good. So continue. I'm sorry, I cut you off.
So he is it, or it? It's a he, because it's, yeah, Mr. Morden. He's surrounded by all of the lost things and the tossed off things and the things that nobody wants anymore. And in the next three stories, two one-offs and a longer arc again, that is a repeated theme. Is so when Cliff goes inside Jane's mind, it's littered with tossed off things that nobody wants anymore. In the next arc, the On Creator arc, again, there's all these themes of, like, there are various characters. We could talk about Grant Morrison's creative mind in terms of coming up with characters. Again, there is a group whose whole shtick is they're created by tossed off things. And even in the last arc, there is a theme of tossed off things too. So I think that is a really interesting, as we go forward in our discussion. I don't know how much longer we're going to, or how much time we're going to spend on the other three pieces in this work, but I think it's very interesting how, you know, Grant Morrison ties these things together as well.
Yes. I mean, yeah, to speak to your point, I think that, you know, we laugh at how silly and off the wall and psychedelic his stories are. But in spite of all this, these are basically character studies. I mean, where, you know, like you said, he's focusing on those three main characters from Doom Patrol who are damaged people. They have real issues. And the absurdity of the situations they're thrown into just highlights the fact that, or rather, it serves as a metaphor for them dealing with the pain of their lives. And I am endlessly fascinated by Morrison's ability to do that, to take these absurd situations, but craft it in such a way that it's a personal story dealing with real issues.
Yeah.
To speak to that, the next one-off story, Cliff Steele has to enter into the mind of Jane. And this is an interesting metaphor as well. Her mind is literally the underground. All of her personalities are buried underground.
And it's a jigsaw.
And it's a jigsaw puzzle of things put together. And Cliff has to descend. It's a subway. She has to descend via a subway.
Metaphorical subway, Cliff is sent into her mind via Rebus. It doesn't really matter, but it's the Doom Patrol, so that's how it happens.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's comics and a thing happened. So, yes, so he descends further and further down, meeting more and more of the personalities, these aspects of her life and her and who she wants to be until it gets to the bottom, which is the source of her trauma and is the fact that she was abused as a child, molested as a child. And it's devastating.
It's rough.
It's hard to read.
It's incredibly well written. It's incredibly well. Again, I'm just going to say Richard Case. Like,
yeah.
Every once in a while in our conversation, I'm just going to randomly say Richard Case because holy crow.
Yeah, it's beautiful and disturbing. It's heartfelt and moving. It is this. You know, wow. There's not much more to say to that than Morrison knows how to.
Yeah,
how to hurt.
With this story, I feel like we need. We have nothing to add.
No, this is something that must be read and not, I can't do justice to describing it.
But yeah. It is, but it's also incredibly moving.
Yes, and absolutely.
It also demonstrates in many ways, the story is about a lot of things and I don't want to make it about Grant Morrison, although as the writer, there is an example of Grant Morrison's, incredible mind for creating characters and naming characters. And he goes through a great amount of Jane's personas. And it's really, really interesting. And it gets more fun because this isn't fun, but it gets more fun in the next story arc where he really just goes off the rails in terms of creating...
Yes, and this, of course, is the storyline where we meet John Constantine. I mean, Willoughby Kipling.
Willoughby Kipling.
Willoughby Kipling, who is this character who is essentially John Constantine, except he dresses in black rather than yellow trench coat.
Is a bit more, a bit less cool.
Yes, a bit less, a bit creepier.
Mm-hmm.
So he is dealing with the cult of the unwritten.
The cult of the, the cult of the unwritten book.
Yeah, Tolls of the Unwritten Book.
And so this is where I get, you know, this is where I got, like, you know, like the previous arc, like it seemed to, with your knowledge of art and things like that, whereas this one, I'm like, it's all literary references. Holy crow.
Well, religion as well. I mean, the theological implications of this are amazing. So essentially, there's this cult that's looking for, you know, the word of God or the word of the anti-God.
Mm-hmm.
Which has been tattooed on the body of a man, just a normal everyday guy, and the Doom Patrol and Willoughby and the Doom Patrol have to help him, have to protect him. But okay, so
the character's name is he is the Book of the Fifth Window.
Okay, do you know if that has a reference to something? Because I do not. It must have something.
I think it's just a reference. To you think of like when you think of a walled in space, there are four sides, right?
Okay,
so you have so each side has a window, But so, like, spaces, created spaces generally are squares or rectangles or whatever, but you have four distinct, you know, so a fifth window is, a fifth window doesn't make, you know, doesn't make sense. I mean, you could have five windows, but.
No, but there's four gospels. There's four gospels, and then that would be the fifth gospel.
Right. I mean, there's all kinds of, yeah. So, I mean.
There's four elements, and then there's a fifth element. It all makes sense now. Nicely done.
The fifth window is a thing that is not comfortably perceived in our structure of the world.
So, yeah, so they're being chased by, how would you describe these characters?
So I had to write these down.
Okay.
Because I can't remember. But this is Morrison at his best. So yeah. These are different types of, or different members of the Cult of the Unwritten Book. And they're usually groups, they're not individuals, but they're groups, and they have, like, how they were created is also really interesting. I'm not going to go into that because we'd be here for an hour. So some of these groups that contain these completely unique characters within them, and did I mention Richard Case?
Yeah, indeed.
So there's Fear the Sky, there are the Dry Bachelors, there are the Mystery Kites. There's the Never Never Boys, which are Wink and Blink and Nod. There's the Unquiet Face. There are the Needle Children, the Embryo Stains, the Pale Police, the Hiroshima Shadows, the Shroud of Stilts, Whispering Jack, the Weeping Blades, and the Little Sisters of Our Lady of the Razor.
Wow. Now, any other creator would have used each one of these in a single storyline. These are just done page to page, which is amazing.
They just show up in a panel.
Right.
They're nightmarish. And within those panels, he often gives like a brief explanation of just a couple of them real quick. So the Dry Bachelors are made of dead skin that people have sloughed off. The Mystery Kites are the skins of murder victims.
It's gruesome and bizarre. Who are the ones that only speak in anagrams?
Oh, those are the Pale Police.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. But the thing that got me was this whole thing is they're trying to revive the anti-god. And the way the anti-god is described is that in the beginning, there was God. And God said, let there be light. And as soon as that light shone, it cast a shadow. And that's the anti-god. The anti-creator.
Because I wrote that down and I even highlighted it. I used a highlighter on that particular thing because it's the direct quote is, you know, the first light of creation cast the first shadow.
That's just such juicy theology. I love it. It's so great. Oh, there's so many implications of that. So they're trying to revive the anti-creator in order to end the world, basically. I never really understood the motivations between for cults to want to end the world, but.
Well, and the cult is this weird thing that exists in a snow globe, right? In a fake city called Nurnheim. And so in order to get forth, to come into the world, they have to go through, not a stigmata, what's the...
A stigmata.
Stigmata, thank you.
Yes.
Right. And so there's a poor guy who has the wound in his hand, and at some point, poor Cliff gets sucked into the stigmata while everything else is coming out. He gets sucked into it. And then he is literally living in a snow. He finds himself in this Nurnheim city that is in a snow globe that Jane had given him as a present.
And that, of course, is a metaphor for his own existence because his brain is inside the robot, which he's living inside his own personal snow globe, as it were. So there's layers upon layers upon layers.
It's hard to go into detail about this. It's a lot of there's a lot of literary references. There's a lot of theology going on, and it manifests itself into basically like an eye in the sky. There's some body part imagery going on in this, only sideways.
Yeah. You mentioned Richard Case, right?
Yes. Did we mention Richard Case? And of course, Doom Patrol saves the day. Although it's the denouement is kind of. It's a little weird because he builds up and builds up and there's all this, you know, and we also, you know, the fact that he talks about all these terrible things going on throughout the world. And most of these horrible things happening are akin to the characters that he's creating too. Like they're not based on the character, these weird characters he's creating. He's just creating these random terrible events that don't make any sense. You know, there's the Virgin Mary that bleeds sour milk every 28 days. You know, it's just all these crazy, insane things that happen to the world as sort of the anti-god is being brought into fruition, and all of these parts of the cult of the unwritten book are being released into the world.
And this story kind of plays into the previous one, The Pain in the Paris, because of the absurdity of the whole thing. I mean, right. Morrison's just descending further and further and beyond this to the end of into other arcs in the future.
Well,
yeah.
And in The Pain in the Paris, the characters are sucked into a world in the cult of the unwritten book. Characters are being brought forth into the world.
Right. So the absurdity is made real.
I don't know if people have watched the Doom Patrol show.
I have. I would say I have not. I've started to watch it. I have not finished it.
Anybody who has watched, I would assume that folks who are watching the Doom Patrol, the DC Universe show, would have read this. But if they hadn't, I'll tell you, the show pulls very heavy. I mean, these are the plot lines in the show. Oh, the other thing that I just wanted to mention real quick about the Cult of the Unwritten Book, the leaders of the Cult of the Unwritten Book, or when Cliff gets into the heart of the city in the snow globe, they are two. It's a puppet king puppet queen,
right,
who are both inactive, but holding in their hand. The two puppets are both holding puppets, and the puppets that the puppets are holding are the living things, and they're Punch and Judy.
Right, you know. We are being, you know, the entire universe is puppets being controlled by puppets being controlled by puppets.
Right. And those puppets are Punch and Judy.
It's, wow.
It's crazy. So I did say the word crazy, but.
No, it's just fabulous stuff. And this was, like I said earlier, this was so influential because so many people reading this, so many other creators were reading this, or soon to be creators, were reading this and saying, oh, so you can do this in comics? And you see this, Morrison's influence is far-reaching. There's a reason he's in the pantheon of great comic book writers. And did we mention Richard Case?
We might have.
Okay.
I just can't imagine if he had had, you know, we're still in like kind of pseudo four color. I mean, it's a little better than four color comics, obviously, and this was a prestige format at the time, but imagine, like, you look at artists now and the way that they're able to digitally create and all of these things. Imagine him being let loose with the tools that artists have now. There's one more one-off story. I think it's kind of sweet and bittersweet.
It's a brain in a jar story.
It's Mansoor Mala, the talking, you know, ape, and brain, you know, the brain in a jar,
right,
that have been consistently present in the DC universe again as like let's call them M-listers in terms of, they're not Z-listers, they're not D-listers, we'll call them M-listers, who keep getting killed, I think, numerous times. You know, the final story, it's just a one-off story. It's about Cliff again, his brain is in a jar, he's getting his body reconfigured because
Chief sucks, by the way.
Good by Niles Calder, because he didn't approve of the way Will Magnus, the great Will Magnus, had created previous body. Cliff goes through a few bodies through this. He's left alone there. His brain is in a jar. His body's here. His body gains consciousness. There's a lot of philosophical discussion between the brain and the body.
Well, what is it? What makes that? You know, it's a very flippant way to talk about what is consciousness,
right?
Or you know, if you're a brain in a jar, do you still have consciousness? Do you physically manifest through your body? Is it your body that control? Anyway,
yeah.
It's a very old story. It's one that's used many times in science fiction.
Yeah, it's not a new.
New, but Grant Morrison puts his twist on it by putting a talking ape and two brains in jars.
There's two brains in jars, and there's a scene where the two brains are arguing with each other. The two brains in jars are arguing with each other. But spoiler alert, at the end, of course, Monster Mbala and the Brain are killed because Cliff's body explodes due to a hilarious bit of stage business. There's also, chewing gum plays an important part. But, the Mala and the Brain show up because they're going to show the Doom Patrol what's what for once,
That's like a terrible sitcom. It's Mala and the Brain.
And, of course, at the moment of truth, then Mala and the Brain confess their love for each other. So you have a Brain and, a talking ape who finally are able to realize their love for each other. And then they blow up.
Yeah, so it is a sweet little story. It's a one-off. Cliff does get his brain put back in a body eventually. But yeah, this is not just this. The entire run of Morrison's Doom Patrol is just an amazing piece of work. It's a classic of comic books. I wish we could have done the entire thing. In fact, I did read the entire run of Morrison, not just this arc.
I had a little bit of sadness when you were picking out which one to do, and I think this is the right one. But for some reason, I thought Danny the Street was going to be in this arc.
Believe me,
in the next issue.
I know. Believe me, I put a lot of thought into this. If we only had to choose one, I wanted to have it be to epitomize what it is that he was doing, but not to be so far gone. Like if we did the Magic Bus, that would have been so off the rails.
And we wouldn't have had the context of what came before this, which I think was necessary.
Exactly. So. But I didn't want to go all the way back, although the Scissorman was an amazing thing.
The Scissorman, yeah.
But
I think if folks are listening to this and they haven't read this, seems odd to me, but there's a ton of comic book arcs that I have not read that people might be like, what's wrong with you? How have you not read this?
Exactly.
So look forward to this, but also look forward to what comes. And Danny the Street, prepare yourself for what I think is one of my very favorite characters in all of comics. You're in for a treat when you keep reading.
Well, to sum up.
In summation.
I mean, all right, so it's kind of cliche to say this, but Doom Patrol subverts the genre of comics. But it doesn't, at the time...
Because it's exactly what it does.
I know, but it how many times have we heard that?
But it's why that phrase exists.
Yeah, but at the time, in order to subvert the genre, things had to be dark and gritty and realistic. But rather than doing that, Morrison embraces and highlights how inherently goofy this genre is. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, he's able to tackle some pretty heavy subjects like race and abuse and sexuality and mental illness and politics and religion, and all in a way that doesn't seem forced and obvious,
right?
Because he's playing with what this thing comic books can do. He does it in such a way that it helps grow the genre, not just subvert.
Very few writers in comics have I ever encountered that have used the medium in such a way as Morrison does. I mean, there are important writers, and there are writers who have written and done interesting things on the pages. And there are artists who certainly have played with the concept of how visual art is represented. But I think Morrison just consistently does it over and over and over again in a way that I don't even think the great bearded one...
If you had asked me this in the 90s, I would have said, oh, Alan Moore, man, he's the one everyone needs to emulate. But I was wrong. It's Grant Morrison.
Yeah.
The more I read, the more I learn about the history of comics, the more important Grant Morrison's role in it becomes.
Because he has that great love of the Silver Age.
Right.
Which he gets criticism for. Grant Morrison is not without his critics, and maybe some of our listeners also are
rolling their eyes at us, yeah.
Right, and which is fair, and we all have reasons for liking the creators we like. But he takes that love of the Silver Age and the goofy, sort of wacky stuff and infuses so much meaning and so much, I don't want to say commentary because that makes it sound dry.
No, he merges it with... with, like we were talking about, philosophy and art and and modern ideas, but he still takes that love of the goofy, wacky Silver Age and Bronze Age. He loves that stuff. And that's what, you know, that's why I fell in love with comics. And I think, you know, and it's because of the unbridled creativity and wackiness of that time that enabled all these things that we talk about now to come about. There wouldn't need to be a dark and gritty reboot if there wasn't the silly, happy, you know, four-color wackiness. You know, comic books should be fun, even when they're talking about dark subjects.
And Grant Morrison is, personally, I find to be very fun. Can I read Grant Morrison on the surface? Well, some of his stuff, sure. You know, I mean, you don't have to be an intellect to read his, you know, Batman run. I mean, intellect is a word, you know, but you can enjoy his like, say, his run on Batman or his run on JLA or his run on X-Men with where you don't have to, if you just want to read for fun, which I love reading for fun. That's the most important reason to read. But so you can read for fun or you can read more into it if you wish to. And Grant, in most of Grant Morrison's work, he allows you that option.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So I'm assuming you highly recommend this?
Well, of course.
Yeah, as do I. I hope we made sense to this really hard to describe story arc. Or story arcs.
There's so many other rewards in this story arc that we just, you know, there are lines like just that are so great. There are visual jokes. There's a great joke, a visual joke of, did I mention Richard Case? There's a great moment where when the Doom Patrol first enters the painting that A. Paris, where they're standing there and they're miniaturized, and in the background you see Booster Gold. I don't know. I can't remember. It's Animal Man. It's either Booster Gold or Black or Blue Beetle. Like looking in, you see their huge faces just kind of looking in. And it's just that humorous bit of like, you know, people staring in a window. And it's just it's a wonderful visual gag.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. There's so much we both mentioned earlier on. We can keep going back to this and pick out more. There's a richness here. And it can be endlessly entertaining to go back and read it again. Yeah.
Doom Patrol, read it.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Next time, I believe, Paul, we will be reading your recommendation. It's finally back to one of us. And folks, we are back, we believe, on schedule. So
yeah, we should be getting these out on a regular schedule again. There was the beginning of 2020 was a struggle.
Yes,
but I think we're back to it again.
We're back in it. So,
I can tell you that I miss doing this. I'm glad we're back. Yeah.
So, Paul, you're next. What are we reading next time?
We are going to be reading Squadron Supreme, the 1985 12-issue Justice League homage / satire by Mark Gruenwald, with art by Bob Hall and Paul Ryan.
All right.
Yeah. So this should be an interesting conversation. And may answer the question, was this Watchmen before Watchmen?
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. So keep that in mind.
All right.
Put a pin in that. We'll come back to it. And if nothing else, we get to make wizard jokes. So again, so it's Squadron Supreme, 1985, 12 issues. Mark Gruenwald, the great Mark Gruenwald, and Bob Hall and Paul Ryan doing the art.
All right.
So thanks, everybody, for listening. Sorry for the delay. We couldn't get it together to put out more issues, but we are back, and we're going to try to put out as many of these as we possibly can in the upcoming weeks and months.
Yes.
So let us know what you think, as always, on the website, collectededition.com. You can leave us a comment, or on Twitter, collectededpod, that's collectededpod. Hit us up, ask us some questions, let us know what you think. We really do appreciate your feedback. Anything else to add, Brian?
I do not.
Okay. So stay safe, and as my dear friend always says,
be well.
Exactly. See you next time, everybody.
Toodles.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter at collectededpod. That's collected, E-D-P-O-D. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained?